Good evening. Today we'll be learning Lakuta Sichas, the Sicha on Parshas Yisrei, the first Sicha on Parshas Yisrei in volume 11 of Lakuta Sichas. The beauty of learning a Sicha is that although every Sicha is about an individual idea and the Rebbe will ask a question and the Rebbe will give an answer, but every Sicha is also part of a narrative which tells us, and it's a very unique way of how the Rebbe views the Torah and views our relationship with Torah. And obviously this Sicha is no different. So in addition to understanding the details of the Sicha and studying and exploring the particular topic of the Sicha, we're going to be getting a little taste of the way the Rebbe in general, the way the Rebbe studies Torah, and the way the Rebbe wants us to view Torah. The Rebbe said many, many times that the word Torah comes from the root, the word Hira. Hira, which means a lesson. It's a life lesson for us. Torah, even though that there are a lot of stories in Torah, and it seems to be chronicles historical events, but ultimately the purpose of Torah is not to tell us history. And that's something which is also very evident when you study Torah, when you read the stories of Torah, and you'll notice that sometimes there are gaps, big gaps, hundreds of years, when it seems to be, there could have been consequential events that could have happened, and sometimes a small little episode which seems to be irrelevant in the larger context, and the Torah elaborates upon it and tells us a lot of details about a story which you look at it and like, okay, did it even matter much at the time, and how much more so here we are thousands of years later. So for example, this week's parsha is Yisrei. So last week in Parshas Beshalach, we had a lot of very, very interesting stories, and we can see how they're very important. For example, you have the story of the splitting of the sea, and that's obviously an incredible story, an incredible miracle, and obviously it makes sense the fact that the Torah tells it over to us in great detail. Then we have the story of the man, and then we have the story of the well, the water coming from the rock. These are all obviously important stories and important part of our history. And then in this week's parsha, obviously we have what's arguably the most important story of our history as a nation, which is Matan Torah. We have it in this week. But the beginning of this week's parsha, which is going to be the focus of the Sicha, is about a person whose name was Yisrei, and the name of the parsha. The parsha's name is Yisrei. So we have here Yisrei, who's a father-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu, and as we know, Moshe Rabbeinu, he got married in Midian, because he fled Mitzrayim when he was a young man. He ended up in Midian and married a woman from Midian. Her name was Tzipora. And when Moshe Rabbeinu comes back to Mitzrayim to redeem the Jewish people, he leaves behind his wife and his two sons. Originally, he took them along, but somehow or other, they ended up back in Midian for reasons which are debated by the Mefarshim. But at this point in time, which this is shortly before Matan Torah, so Moshe's father-in-law, Yisrael, makes an appearance. He comes together with Moshe's wife and Moshe's two children. And the entire beginning of this week's parsha talks about how how Moshe's father-in-law, Yisrael, how he comes to Midbar Sinai, to where the Jews are, and he meets up over there with Moshe Rabbeinu. And it tells us the story of how he came and how Moshe tells him the whole story of Yitzias Mitzrayim and how Yisrael then blessed Hashem. And again, in the larger context and the larger, through the lens of history, it seems to be pretty insignificant. By way of contrast, you have the Yidden were in the desert for 40 years, 38 years, 38 of those years, and it's safe to say that there were interesting things that happened during those 38 years. The Torah tells us nothing about it. The Torah skips from after the story pretty much of Korach for 38 years. This is a little later in Bamidbar, but just to give you a little context how there are interesting gaps in the Torah, and then the Torah will take anecdotes or episodes which seem to be relatively insignificant and expands upon them. And this tells us something, again, the point that I've spoken about many times, this tells us that when the Torah tells us a story, it's not about telling us history, because if it was telling us history, it would probably focus more on the important events, and it would leave out these seemingly inconsequential events, but rather, the Torah is about lessons. And those stories that are lessons for our life, the Torah tells us. And that's really what the Rebbe does in all the Sichas, or almost all the Sichas, is the Rebbe is looking at the Torah and finding out, what is this telling us? Instead of us learning a story that happened some 3,300 years ago, we're actually really reading the story of our lives in the Torah. Sometimes we look at the story and we could see the life lesson it screams out at us. And the Rebbe does that many times, just taking the story on its, at face value, analyzing the story and taking out from the story many important lessons. And this is something that not only the Rebbe does, but the Rebbe encourages us to do the same. When we look at the story of the Torah, is to find the lessons. Sometimes there are lessons that are also that can be found by digging a little deeper. Looking through the Mamari Chazal, looking through what our sages over the millennia have said about the story, and this and these add new elements to the lesson that we are meant to take from the story. And this sicha, this talk that we are going to be learning today, which is a talk which the Rebbe gave on Shabbos Parshas Yisrei in 1965. So this is one of those instances where the Rebbe is going to give us a few Mamari Chazal, some of the sayings of our sages on the story, and using those, the insights of our sages, we're going to come up with a very powerful lesson again in our lives. The first thing we're going to do is we are going to read the story as it appears in the Torah. In your handout that you have, it's on page 1, text 1. We'll read it in English. This is Pasha, the story in the Torah. Yisrael, the Kohen of Midian, Moshe's father-in-law, heard all that Hashem had done for Moshe and his people Israel, that Hashem had taken Israel out of Egypt. Moshe's father-in-law Yisrael and Moshe's sons and his wife came to Moshe to the desert where he was encamped to the mountain of Hashem. Moshe told his father-in-law all that Hashem had done to Pare and to the Egyptians on account of Israel and about all the hardships that had befallen them on the way and that Hashem had saved them. Yisrael was happy about all the good that Hashem had done for Israel, that he had rescued them from the hands of the Egyptians. Yisrael said, "Blessed is Hashem, who has rescued you from the hands of the Egyptians and from the hands of Pare, who has rescued the people from beneath the hands of the Egyptians. Now I know that Hashem is greater than all the gods." So again, this is the basic story. Yisrael arrives. Moshe tells Yisrael the whole story, you know, catches him up on the latest news. Yisrael maybe didn't have access so much to the WhatsApps and to the emails, and he didn't know all the details of what had transpired. And Moshe tells him everything that has happened. And in response, Yisrael is very, very happy, and he blesses Hashem for having saved the Yidden from the hands of their oppressors, from the hands of the Egyptians. The Gemara, the Sanhedrin, this is going to be text 2, the Gemara says something which on the surface seems to be a little bizarre. And that is, let's read this inside, text 2. Yisrael said, "Blessed is Hashem who has rescued you. A Tana taught in the name of Rapapayas, it is a disgrace for Moshe and the 600,000 Jews that they did not say Baruch," in other words, they did not bless Hashem, "until Yisrael arrived and said, Blessed be Hashem." This is strange because it's hard to imagine that Moshe and the Jewish people had not blessed Hashem up until this point, especially since in last week's parsha, in Parsha's B'Shalach, we have the famous Az Yasher, that after the sea split and the Yidden were saved, the Jews were saved, and the Egyptians were drowned. So the Jews, unanimously, they sang a song of praise to Hashem, a very famous song of praise, which is part of our davening, which we say every single day in the morning in Shacharis. So what does it mean? It's making it sound like Yisrael was the first person ever to bless Hashem, and it's a disgrace for the Jewish people and for Moshe that no one thought of blessing Hashem till Yisrael arrived. What does this mean? Simple question. The Zohar says something different, but also with similarities. And that would be text 3. This is from the second Zohar, volume 2, page 68a. The Zohar says, "Came Yisrael, the illustrious high priest, a master of all other deities, and praised Hashem and said, Now I know that Hashem is the greatest of all the other gods. It was then that the Holy One, blessed be He, ascended and was made known in His greatness on high and below, and then the Torah was given in its entirety." So the Zohar is telling us that the event that occurs and is described later on in this week's parasha in Yisrael, which is the giving of the Torah, it was necessary to have first Yisrael come and bless Hashem, and only then, because of the reaction in heaven that caused, was the Torah able to be given to Klal Yisrael. So that kind of does explain why it is that we have this, again, this episode which doesn't seem to be very important, why the Torah elaborates upon it, but based on what the Zohar says, that kind of makes sense, because it was a prerequisite to giving the Torah, but it doesn't really help us understand why was it a prerequisite to giving the Torah. Why is it necessary? You have 600,000 Jewish people over here, and all of them are holy people and wonderful people. They've just spent 49 days in a whole process of character refinement, which is known as the Sefirah Soemer. They're ready to receive the Torah, but we say no. That in order to receive the Torah, what's necessary is for Yisrael to come and to say Baruch Hashem. Okay, you can say the Zohar is not as strange as the Gemara, because the Gemara says, you know, talks about the disgrace on Moshe and on Kali Yisrael that they didn't bless Hashem. Here, we're not saying anything negative about the Jewish people, but once again, we still do have to understand, why is this blessing that Yisrael gave Hashem, why is it so weighty? Why is it so important to the extent that the giving of the Torah was contingent upon this occurrence? So, the Rebbe poses these questions, and the Rebbe says, before we get to answer these questions, as is typical in the studying of Sichas, but in general in studying in the Yeshiva style, is you ask a question, and then you shelve the question for a little while, and you ask another question, and then you go off to something which is seemingly on the side, but then eventually we come back and we answer the original question also. So the Rebbe says that perhaps the key to answering this whole, to understanding the Gemara, understanding the Zohar, lies in text 1. Let's go back for a moment. It says over here, back to the beginning of text 1, on page 1, Yisroi, the Kohen of Midian, Moshe's father-in-law, heard all that Hashem had done for Moshe, etc. So Yisroi is described over here as the Kohen of Midian. The Kohen, the priest. What does that mean? So in Chazal, in the teachings of the sages, there are two different explanations brought down for what this means. Also in the biblical commentators, some say that the word Kohen means a Kohen is a minister or someone who is a high government official. So according to this understanding, when we're talking about Yisrael being the Kohen of Midian, we're talking about that he was a person who was in the upper echelons of the royalty of Midian. He was high up. He was considered a very prominent figure in Midian. That's one understanding of the word Kohen. Another understanding of the word Kohen is that a Kohen means a priest, and that takes us to text 4, where Rashi says that when Yisrael says, now I see that Hashem is greater than all the gods, Yisrael wasn't just saying this out of ignorance, he was saying this from a place of knowledge. Rashi says, now I know that God is greater than all the gods. This teaches us that he, Yisrael, was knowledgeable about every type of idolatry in the world, and there was no pagan deity that he did not worship. So Yisrael was a priest, but not only a priest of one specific denomination of idolatry, he had dabbled in every single possible idolatry that existed at that time, and he was knowledgeable in every single one of them, and therefore when he proclaimed and says, now I know that Hashem is greater than all the other gods, he had experienced and studied every other god. And then when Moshe told him the story about Yetzias Mitzrayim and about Kriyas Yamsuf, he was able to proclaim again with academic integrity and say, I can tell you for a fact, because I know this is my area, of expertise, that Hashem is greater than all other gods. Okay, so those are the two meanings of the word Kohen, but the question remains, why does the Pasuk tell us this over here? Again, if we're going with the assumption that the Torah, which is Hashem's word to us, every single word in Torah is precise, the fact that Yisrael was the Kohen Midian, whatever Kohen Midian means, whichever interpretation you choose, but the fact that Yisrael was Kohen Midian, we know that from earlier on. When we're first introduced to Yisrael a few Torah portions ago, when it says that Moshe arrives in Midian and we're first introduced to Midian, we're first introduced to Yisrael. Yisrael is introduced to us as Kohen Midian. So we already know that. Why is the Torah repeating it over here? Again, every word in Torah is precise and Torah is concise. And therefore, if the Torah is repeating it here, that means that it has some sort of relevance to what we're talking about over here. And the Rebbe explains that we're trying over here, the Torah over here is trying to lavish praise upon Yisrael. The more we understand how great Yisrael was, the more we understand the sacrifice that he made to leave everything behind, his previous life behind, and instead to join Klal Yisrael in the Sinai Desert. So if we're going to say that Yisrael was a notable personality and a prominent personality in Midian, so then we understand why the Pasuk is saying it over here. Yisrael, although he was the Kohen Midian, although he enjoyed a life of luxury in Midian, and he enjoyed a lot of respect in Midian, nevertheless, he decided to leave it all behind and come to Klal Yisrael. So that's why the Torah repeats it over here, because this is a mark of distinction for Yisrael. But also, if we're to say that Yisrael was a priest, and specifically, he wasn't just Stam a priest, he wasn't any priest. He was very, very learned in different religions and the different deities of the time. That also gives us to understand a little of how great Yisrael was and the contribution he made specifically to the Jewish people at that time. For the reason, in order to understand that, the Rebbe says, first we have to dig a little deeper into, we're talking about Yisrael being familiar with all the different deities and all the different types of idolatry that there was around at that time. Let's talk a little about idolatry. And again, by the time we finish this class, everything will come back together and we'll see how everything fits in. Be'ezrat Hashem. The age-old question is, how and where did idolatry begin? After all, we know that Hashem created Adam and Chava, and he put them in Gan Eden. And Adam and Chava were very aware of Hashem. Hashem communicated directly with Adam and Chava, definitely with Adam. So you would assume that this is information that they would have relayed to their children, and their children to their children. How is it that suddenly one day someone stands up and pulls out a little statue made out of gold or wood or silver and says, "This is my God"? Or how is it that one day someone turns to, you know, we talk about idolatry in Jewish literature is often called Oivet Kechavim Mazalos, those who worship the stars and the different constellations. How did it happen that one day someone woke up and said, even though that I heard from my father, my grandfather, my mother, my grandmother, that there is a one God that created heaven and earth, I decided that, no, Jupiter is a God. I decided this star is a God. Where did that come from? Where did it originate from? So the Rambam discusses this at length in the first chapter of the Laws of Idolatry. And let's look at that in text 5a. Again, this all will become relevant as we move along. Text 5a on page 2. During the times of Enosh, Enosh was a grandchild of Adam, mankind made a great mistake, and the wise men of that generation gave thoughtless counsel. Enosh himself was one of those who erred. Their mistake was as follows. They said that Hashem created stars and spheres with which to control the world. He placed them on high and treated them with honor, making them servants who minister before him. Accordingly, it is fitting to praise and glorify them and to treat them with honor. They perceived this to be the will of Hashem, blessed be he, that they magnify and honor those whom he magnified and honored, just as a king desires that the servants who stand before him be honored. Indeed, doing so is an expression of honor to the king. After conceiving of this notion, they began to construct temples to the stars and offer sacrifices to them. They would praise and glorify them with words and prostrate themselves before them, because by doing so, they would, according to their false conception, be fulfilling the will of Hashem. This was the essence of idol worship, and this was the rationale of those who worshiped them. They would not say that there is no other God except for this star. So Rambam is telling us that the mistake began as follows. It wasn't that one day someone woke up and decided that Hashem doesn't exist and there is another entity that created the world, but rather they looked around the world and they realized that Hashem conducts this world through the various messengers, through various agents, including the stars and the angels and the constellations. And they figured, listen, if there's a king over here in this world, a king of flesh and blood, and the king has servants, the king has ministers, it is actually a way of honoring the king is by honoring the king's servants. So therefore, if we go and we will honor and worship and give respect to these various agents that Hashem uses in order to create the world, and by the way, the physical idols they had were only physical representations of these larger spiritual powers, which indeed do actually control the world. And they were like, this is what Hashem would want of us. Hashem would want that we should accord honor and respect to those servants that he saw fit to manage the affairs of this world. But they did not, originally at least, they did not deny Hashem. But then you know how the way things have a way of evolving, and there's a slippery slope. And eventually, a few generations later, what happened was that Hashem became forgotten, and these people totally forgot about Hashem, and they suddenly, all they knew about was the angels and the stars and the saints and all these different other authority figures, which they figured now were complete charge of the world. And the Rambam therefore continues in text 5b. The Rambam says, the essence of the commandment forbidding idol worship is not to serve any of the creations, not an angel, a sphere, a star, none of the four fundamental elements, nor any entity created from them. Even if the person worshiping knows that Hashem is the true God and serves the creation in a matter in which Anash and the people of his generations worshiped the stars originally, he is considered to be an idol worshiper. The Torah warns us about this, saying, lest you lift your eyes heavenward and see the sun, the moon, and the stars, and bow down and worship to them, the entities which Hashem apportioned to all the nations. This implies that you might inquire, and it might appear to you that these entities control the world, having been apportioned by Hashem to all the nations to be alive, to exist, and not to cease existence, as is the pattern of the other creations with the world. Therefore, you might say that it is worthy to bow down to them and worship them. So what is Avodah Zarah? What is idolatry? Idolatry is the notion of ascribing any sort of authority or power to anything other than Hashem. Because this was a big mistake that was made by Enosh. The fact is, the term that is used very often to describe all these different messengers and agents that Hashem employs in the running of this world is Kegarzen Biyada Chetzavbay, which means that these are all actually like an axe in the hands of the woodchopper. And just like no one would think, if you have a very fine table made out of wood, mahogany, you would say, oh wow, let me give some credit to the carpenter, let me give a little credit to the knife, the blade that the carpenter used in fashioning it. No, because the blade has no agency, it has no free choice. And the same thing is all these stars and all the angels and all the messengers and everything, all of these things, they do not have any free choice on their own. They are merely instruments in the hands of Hashem. And because they're only instruments, it's a big mistake to accord them any honor or respect or to worship them in any which way. And by the way, this makes idolatry also much more relevant to us. You know, it's easy to talk about the people who lived, you know, the backward Neanderthals who lived 4,000 years ago, worshiped idols. We would never worship idols. But once we understand what idol worship really is, that idol worship is about assuming that there is anything in the world, in this world or any other world, that has any control or authority over us, other than Hashem. If there's anything other than Hashem that is able to control our fate in any which way, and we ask ourselves then, okay, so what are my idols? What do I believe controls me and my fate and my destiny? And what is it that controls my ability to be able to make some money or not be able to make some money or to be able to have happiness? And we realize that the idea of believing in Hashem to the exclusion of any other power is actually, it takes effort, it's an avodah, it's work, this idea, this emunah, the belief that the only thing that controls anything, that is the essence of monotheism. The essence of monotheism is understanding that Hashem is in absolute control of everything always, and everything else, whether it's a force of nature, whether it's my job, whether it's my boss, whether it's my spouse, whether it's my past, my genes, all of these things are only instruments in the hand of Hashem, and the only one who really controls everything is Hashem. Now, when we say that Yisrael was familiar with every single sort of idolatry in the world, every single deity that there was, and then he turns around and says, Ata Yadaiti, now I am aware, Ki Gadol Hashem Mikol HaLekim, that God is greater than all these other deities, now we're understanding this is not a small thing. When we're talking about that, what this basically means was that Yisrael was familiar with all the various agents of Hashem's, of God's energy that enter this world, which is no small feat. I don't know if any one of us sitting over here can say that we're familiar with every single angel and every single agent of, again, God's, what we call Hashpa, God's effluence to this world. And Yisrael is saying, I'm familiar with all of them. And you know, different nations, they will idolize and they'll worship this one or that one and this agent and this force. And I'm telling you, being familiar with all of them, I know they're nothing. All of them are nothing compared to Hashem, because ultimately Hashem is the one who is in control of everything. That's pretty great. So therefore, when the Pasuk says over here, Vayishma Yisrei Kohen Midyan, that Yisrei, who was the Kohen, the priest of Midyan, came, and he joined Klal Yisrael, whether we understand the word Kohen as meaning a great dignitary over there, a prominent personality in Yisrei, whether we understand it as meaning that he was the priest who really was familiar with the whole spiritual, you might want to say, cosmology of everything that happens, and he was the one who came to the recognition that ultimately Hashem is greater than them all, and Hashem controls them all, this is actually a great praise to Yisrei, and we understand why the Torah will tell us, Kohen Midyan, exactly who he is. All of this that we discussed up until this point is very relevant to the original question that we asked, which is, we have here this story about Yisrei coming to the desert, and the Torah makes a big deal out of it. Why does the Torah make a big deal out of it? But we're beginning to see how it actually was a very, very important event. The fact that we have Yisrei, this idolater, this person who was in what we'd call the depths of Klipa, in the depths of unholiness, and familiar with every single Klipa and unholiness that there is, and he comes and he acknowledges Hashem's existence, this was a very pivotal moment. And this was a turning point, which, as we will see, allowed for the giving of the Torah. And this idea is a foundation in Chabad Chassidus. As we will see in a moment, we're talking about the foundation of that the ultimate light comes from the transformation of darkness. And this is alluded to in a Pasuk in Koheles, which is text 6, page 4, where the Pasuk says, in Hebrew it's, V'ra'isi ani sheyesh Yisrein lachachma min hasichlus ki Yisrein ha'oyer min ha'choshach. Where Shlomo HaMelech says, and I saw that wisdom has an advantage over folly, over foolishness, as the advantage of light over darkness. Now, for someone who is known to be the smartest person who ever lived, this statement doesn't seem to be very particularly edifying or very wise. What Shlomo HaMelech is saying is, you know, I finally have come to the recognition that wisdom is advantageous. Wisdom is better than foolishness. In fact, just like light is better than darkness, wisdom is better than foolishness. Do we really need Shlomo HaMelech to be telling this to us? So the Zohar asks this question. The Zohar asks this question, and the Zohar says that actually, if you look at the words Yisrein ha'oyer min ha'choshach in the Hebrew, so Yisrein min ha'choshach, it could be read as the advantage of light over darkness, but the word min can also mean from. And if we understand it that way, then what Shlomo HaMelech is really saying is, I see there's an advantage of wisdom that comes from foolishness, just like there's an advantage of light that emerges and comes from darkness. Just like when you're in the dark and suddenly you're exposed to the light is so much more bright. The same thing is also when there's wisdom, holiness, that emerges from foolishness, from unholiness, there's a great advantage over there. And it's not only that the light seems brighter, it's not only that the holiness seems holier, but it actually, we draw down into this world a much greater level of light, of godliness, when we transform the darkness. This is actually, this past week, we had Yud Shvat, which was the Yahrzeit of the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, the day when our Rebbe became Rebbe, and the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, for the day that he passed away, he gave out a mimer to be studied called Basi Lagani. And it's a mimer which the Rebbe would discuss, and he would himself deliver a Chassidic discourse on this topic of Basi Lagani every year subsequent on the anniversary on the 10th of Shvat. And one of the big themes over there is this idea of how Hashem created a world, specifically a world which was dark. And this is the world that he wants. Yes, there are higher worlds, there are worlds that are holier, where God's light is more revealed, but those worlds don't interest Hashem too much. Hashem wants a world wherein there is darkness, where there is forces of unholiness, and we transform, we repel, and we subdue, and we transform the darkness, and we bring in the light of Hashem in here, and that is the ultimate purpose of creation. And when did this begin? When did the process of transforming the darkness begin. The ability to take a world, which is a world which is filled with the powers, what we call klipa. Klipa means the powers that conceal. Klipa means a husk. The powers that conceal God, and be able to sanctify the world, make the world into a holy place. That really began with the giving of the Torah. In fact, that is the significance of the giving of the Torah. And this is what the Medrash says. Look at text 7 on page 4. The Medrash brings down, the Medrash cites a pasuk in Tehillim, where it says, the heavens are God's domain, and the earth he gave to the human beings. This can be compared to a king who decreed that the residents of Rome may not descend to Syria, and the residents of Syria may not go up to Rome. Similarly, when Hashem created the world, he decreed, the heavens are Hashem's domain, and the earth he gave to the human beings. When he desired to give the Torah, he rescinded this decree and said, those below may ascend on high, and those on high may descend below. The giving of the Torah was the opening shot. This was when we were given the Torah, the mitzvahs, and the ability that here in this physical world to be able to make this world into a holy place. Yisrael ha'er men ha'choshach, that the light of Hashem should be able to emerge from the darkness of a world which obscures Hashem's light. And for this to happen, the preparation for this to happen was Yisrael, who was in the depths of darkness. When he came and he said, Baruch Hashem, that was what gave the ability for later on in this week's Torah portion for the Torah to be given. The Rebbe notes something interesting, which is that, again, when we read the stories of the Torah, it seems to be like, again, we're just telling interesting stories, fascinating stories, but everything has such deep spiritual significance. So we spoke a little while ago about the splitting of the sea. And that sounds like an amazing miracle, and obviously the Jewish people at that time, their lives were being threatened, they were in mortal peril, you know, they're facing the sea and the Egyptians are behind them, and God saves them. But there's also, in the books of Hasidus and Kabbalah, talks about the incredible spiritual significance of the event. After all, if God just wanted to save the Jewish people, anyways, he could have saved them. He didn't have to split the sea. He could have brought another plague of hail on the Egyptian army that was behind them, and that would have been it. He could have done, okay, you know, a few weeks, last week we did the plague of the firstborn, now we're going to do the plague of the secondborn and the thirdborn, right? God could have saved the Jewish people in many different ways. There is a significance to the fact that God chose to split the sea. And not only to split the sea, but the words used to describe the splitting of the sea by the prophets is Hafach Yam LaYabasha, that God transformed the sea into Yabasha, into dry land. What is the importance of that? What is the importance of what is the significance of that? So again, in the books of Chassidus, it is explained that all of creation is divided into what's called Alma de Iskasya, the hidden world, and Alma de Skalia, which is the revealed world. The hidden world, obviously, is the sea would be a metaphor for that, because you look at the ocean, and the ocean, as we know, is teeming with life, but it's all concealed. And then you have the revealed world. The metaphor for that is dry land. Everything that's there, we can see. When it says that by the splitting of the sea, Hafach Yam LaYabasha, the sea was transformed into dry land, that means that the deepest levels of the hidden worlds, the hidden spiritual worlds, were all revealed over here. Which is why it says that the Jewish people, by Kriyas Yamsuf, by the splitting of the sea, they were able to literally point and say, Zeh Keli Van Veyo, this is my God. And the Medrash tells us that even the lowliest maid was exposed to a level of prophecy like the greatest of prophets was by the splitting of the sea. And this also was a preparation for the giving of the Torah, because once again what we have is over here in this physical world, which is what we call the revealed world, we had over here the revelation of the deepest and highest levels of spirituality of the concealed world, and all of this was a process which ultimately led to the giving of the Torah, when again all the boundaries were removed and we have the ability to reveal godliness over here in this world. So then the question becomes, the Rebbe says, if we already had the splitting of the sea, why do we need Yisrael to come? We already had the preparation for the giving of the Torah. The preparation, the merging of the highest levels and the lowest levels, already we already had it by the splitting of the sea. Why do we need a further merging of the highest and lowest level over here with the coming of Yisrael? And the Rebbe explains that the splitting of the sea, yes, it revealed godliness, but it revealed godliness in those areas of this world that were not resistant to godliness. Even here in this world, there are the higher elements of this world. So, for example, the Egyptians, they weren't transformed to holiness. They had to be destroyed. They had to be decimated. Why? Because they remained Egyptians. They remained evil. Even with the splitting of the sea, they were unimpacted by it. Who was impacted by it? The Jewish people. So again, the higher element over here in this world, they were the ones that anyways weren't really resistant to godliness. So they were exposed to greater levels of godliness than they were accustomed to. But that wasn't enough for the Torah to be given. For the Torah to be given, we needed also the godliness should be revealed in a person who was beforehand was resistant to godliness, someone who beforehand was an idol worshiper, and that is Yisrael. And the Rebbe points out something interesting. If you turn to text 8, so this is Rashi on the first verse in Yisrael. So Rashi says, Vayishma Yisrael, Yisrael heard. So Rashi says, what news did he hear that caused him to come? The splitting of the Yamsuf and the war with Amalek. Now this is very strange, because if we look at the verse which we have in text 1, it says over there, Yisrael, the Kohen of Midian, Moshe's father-in-law, heard all that Hashem had done for Moshe and his people Israel, that God had taken Israel out of Egypt. So it says over there what Yisrael heard. It says that Yisrael heard that Hashem had taken the Jews out of Egypt. So why is Rashi saying that what he heard was the splitting of the sea and the war against Amalek? So the Rebbe explains, yes, Yisrael heard about the going out of Egypt. The question is, what Rashi says, Mashmua Shama Uba, what is it that he heard that caused him to come? He heard about the going out of Egypt, but that didn't spur him to come. As we see, he didn't come right away. What spurred him to come? What spurred him to come was, and by the way, the Rebbe asks a second question. It says he heard the splitting of the sea and the war against Amalek. Shouldn't it say that he heard about the splitting of the sea and Israel's victory over Amalek? Why would Amalek's war instigate him to come? It should say the downfall of Amalek, the victory against Amalek. What does it mean? The splitting of the sea and the war of Amalek, and also the juxtaposition of the two. How about the splitting of the sea and the man falling from heaven? What is it about these two? So the Rebbe explains that according to Chassidus, this makes a lot of sense. Yisrael heard that on the one hand the sea was split, which means that it was a great revelation of godliness. And what happens a few weeks later? Amalek comes and attacks the Jewish people. What does that tell us? That tells us that the impact of the revelation that there was by the splitting of the sea did not impact Amalek. Amalek remained resistant to godliness. When Yisrael saw this, he saw the juxtaposition of the splitting of the sea and the war of Amalek. He says, oh, I got to come. In order for the Torah to be given, I need to come, and I need to say Baruch Hashem. I need to say thank you, Hashem, because me, as a former priest, as a former idolater, I'm the one who can be the Makabeh Patish, the straw that breaks the camel's back, and can bring about the Matan Torah. And this is the idea. No one before Yisrael came, before Yisrael, no one said Baruch. What does Baruch mean? You know, we say the word Baruch all the time. We say it in all of our blessings. Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu. What does the word Baruch mean? We're blessing Hashem? How do we as human beings have the ability to bless Hashem, to bless God? So in Chassidus it explains that the word Baruch means to draw down. In Hebrew, the word Brecha means a pool, like a pool of water. When you gather water together, it becomes a pool. Baruch means to draw down. Also related to the word Hamavrich, a similar word. Whenever we say Baruch Atah Hashem, what we're really trying to do is we're trying to draw down godliness over here into this world. Before Yisrael came, no one did a Baruch Hashem. No one was able to draw down God into the lowest element of the world, a place that was formerly resistant to God. That is what Yisrael accomplished. And in a way, it was a disgrace that Moshe and 600,000 Jews, they were not able to accomplish that which Yisrael was able to accomplish. Now, obviously, they couldn't. It's not necessarily their fault, but still, how does it look when you have Moshe and the 600,000 Jewish people and they can't accomplish what one Yisrael is able to come and do? And what we have over here is really, it's pretty amazing how a small little story in the Torah, which seems to be so inconsequential, we see how it's actually a major step that plays into the story that follows, which is the giving of the Torah. That's all nice, but what does this have to do with us? How is this a story of our life? So the Rebbe says, in our lives also, you know, obviously we have to draw down godliness into our own lives. That is our purpose as Jewish people. We learn Torah, we do mitzvahs, we daven, and the purpose of it all is that us, and we are material people, we're not necessarily naturally refined, but through serving Hashem, we expose ourselves to godliness, and we have Yishen Ha'er Min HaChoshech, we're able to make that the light of holiness, should be able to emerge from the darkness within our lives also. And in every single one of our lives, we have the Kriyas Yamsuf element, we have the splitting of the sea element, and we also have the Yisrael element within us. Meaning we have parts of our life that are amenable for godliness to be revealed over there. For example, we wake up in the morning and the first thing we do is we daven. And then after we daven, according to halacha, before we run off to work, we're supposed to spend a few minutes at least studying Torah. And that gives us the fortitude and the strength needed then to go out in the world to make a living and do what else, whatever else is necessary. So those moments of the day, it's very important that we introduce godliness in those hours when we spend those hours we spend praying and those hours that we spend in Torah study. But ultimately, that can be compared to the splitting of the sea. Meaning, yes, we are bringing the Yam into the Yabasha. We're bringing the concealed light of God into the revealed world, into our lives, where it doesn't naturally exist. But can we truly say that by doing so, we are bringing Hashem into the parts of our life that are most resistant to Him? And the answer is no. Which parts of our life are most resistant to Hashem? It's after you finish the davening. It's after you studied a little Torah and you go to work. The trick is, can we be a Jew over there also? Bechol derechacha de'eyu. Can my entire day be about Hashem? Can my entire day be about serving Hashem? And when I'm at work, I'm not losing sight of what the work is all about. The reason why I'm working is to make some money, to be able to support my family so we can serve Hashem. I'm making some money so I can give charity. And when I'm at work also, I'm making sure that if I see someone else around me, someone who I can say a word of Torah to, someone who I can do a mitzvah with, someone who I can put tefillin on with, someone who I can give Shabbos candles, that perhaps you can light Shabbos candles. And I realize that my connection to Hashem isn't limited to the time when I'm spent, when I spend davening or learning. Those are the Yisrael moments of our life. The Yisrael moments of our life are those areas of our life which are naturally resistant to Hashem. When we're thinking about ourselves usually. We're thinking about ourselves and how we can make a little extra money. And when we're able to, from that ultimate darkness, when we talk about darkness, we mean a place where the light of Hashem is not apparent. And if we can also make Yisrael Ha'er Min HaChoshech, if we could say Baruch Hashem at work, and make work also being about blessing Hashem, then we've passed the final hurdle, and then we're really, really ready to receive the Torah in our personal life.